The bathroom. The private bathroom. No robe, no dudes checking me out in the hall. Just me and my bladder headed to take care of business in peace. I went through my morning ritual, including an extra long shower. Private shower. Another thing from my list of future amenities. Water's expensive in Artemis, but it's not like we throw it away. It's a closed system, so what you really pay for is water purification. The hotel room had a gray water reuse shower. The first 20 liters were fresh water. That lasted about 3 minutes. After that, it reheated your used water and gave it back to you. You could be in there as long as you wanted, and you'd only use 20 liters. Important note, do not pee in a gray water reuse shower. I threw on an insanely comfortable terry cloth robe and wrapped my hair in a towel turban. Time to work on the next step of my evil plan. This time I didn't need to do any research. I just needed to brainstorm. I lay back on the bed Jazz never wanted to leave and let my mind wander. The problem. How would I get out of the city? Airlocks won't obey commands from non-EVA guild members. There's a good reason for that. The last thing you want is some untrained dipshit playing around with airlock controls. A misused airlock is a fast and efficient way to kill everyone in a bubble. So, to use an airlock control panel, you have to wave your gizmo over it. It verifies that you're part of the guild. It's a simple, idiot-proofing scheme that's very effective. But no idiot-proofing can overcome a determined idiot. There's a flaw in the system. For safety reasons, airlocks don't have security on their outer doors. If you're in a leaky EVA suit and scrambling to safety, the last thing you want to see is verifying authorization. I just needed someone to operate the controls from the outside. Someone or something. I left the hotel room because the front desk called to say I had to check out or they'd charge me for another night. Then I drove Trigger to Armstrong Down 4, or, as the locals called it, Little Hungary. The Hungarians owned all the metalworking shops, just like the Vietnamese owned life support and Saudis owned welding. I pulled up next to the workshop of Dad's colleague, Josia Strobel, who was apparently named during a severe vowel famine. She was a pressure vessel specialist. When Dad got a contract to install an air shelter, he usually bought one from Josia. She made high-quality product, and Dad's all about quality. I parked Trigger and rapped on the door. Josia slid it open, a crack, peeked out with one eye, and spoke with a thick accent. "You want what?" I pointed to myself. "It's me, Mrs. Strobel. Jazz, Bashara."
"You are daughter of Amar Bashara," she said. "He good man. You are a very nice little girl. Now you're bid."
"Okay. Look, I want to talk to you about something."
"You are unmarried and have sex with many men."
Yes, I'm quite the harlot." Her son, Isvan, had banged more dudes than I ever had. I resisted the urge to tell her. "I just need to borrow something for a couple of days. I'm willing to pay you 1,000 slugs for it." She opened the door a little wider.
"Borrow what?"
"Your hib." Josia had been around for the construction of both Bean and Shepherd bubbles. Bubble construction is a hell of a job. Pays well, too. She and dozens of other metal workers had made the slightly curved triangles that stacked on a frame to form the hull. The EVA masters assembled the pieces and added enough rivets to make a shitty, leaky pressure seal. Then life support kept the bubble fed with enough air to counteract the leaks while welders made the real seals from inside. Dad made good money off those jobs, I remember. Ethical metalworkers like Josia regularly inspect their work. But how do you look at the outside of the hull without being a trained, licensed EVA master? With the hull inspection bot.
HIB for short.
They're really just RC cars with claws instead of wheels. The outer hulls of Artemis are covered in handles to ensure access for maintenance.
HIBs use those handles to get wherever they want.
Seems inefficient, eh? Well, it's the only way to climb up the side of a bubble. The aluminum isn't magnetic, suction cups and propellers don't work in a vacuum, and a rocket engine would be stupidly expensive.
"Why you want HIB?"
she asked. I'd worked out a lie in advance. The Shepherd relief valve is leaking. Dad was the one who installed it. He wants me to check the weld site. Keeping Artemis at constant pressure is tricky. If people use more power than usual, the city becomes slightly overpressurized. Why? The power becomes heat, which increases the air temperature, and that makes the pressure go up. Normally, life support pulls air out of the system to compensate. But what if that doesn't work? So, as a failsafe, the city has relief valves in every bubble. If the pressure gets too high, they'll open and let air out until it's back to normal.
Your father never makes bed weld. Must be other problem.
I know that, and you know that. But we have to rule it out. She thought it over.
How long you need?
Just a couple of days.
1,000 slugs.
I pulled out my gizmo. Yeah, and I'll pay in advance.
You wait.
She slid the door closed. After a minute, Josha opened the door again and handed me a case. I checked inside to make sure everything was there. The mechanical bug was 30 centimeters long. Its four movement claws were folded into their stow position, and the tool arm formed a 7 shape along the top of the robot. That arm had a high-definition camera on the end and basic clamping and grabbing actuators. Perfect for poking at things and recording the results. Exactly what you need when remotely inspecting a hull, and also what I needed for my nefarious plan. She handed me the remote, a sleek little device with knobs and joysticks surrounding a video screen.
You know how to use.
I read the manual online. She frowned.
You break, you pay for fix.
This is just between you and me, right? I hovered my finger over my gizmo screen. The welding guild's always looking for excuses to shit-talk Dad. I don't want to give them ammo.
Amar is good man. Good welder. I will not tell.
So, we have a deal? She pulled out her gizmo.
Yes.
I fired off the funds transfer, and she accepted.
You bring back 2 days.
She returned to her shop and closed the door. Yeah, she was grumpy and thought I was a bimbo, but you know what? I wish everyone was like her. No chit-chat, no bullshit, no pretense of friendship. Just goods and services exchanged for money. The perfect business partner. I did a little shopping in Bean Bubble. It was more expensive than I like, but I needed specialty clothing. Artemis has a small Muslim population, including my dad, so there are a few stores that cater to them. I found a long tan dress with simple colors and a stylish embroidered pattern. It was suitable for even the most conservative Muslim gal. I also bought a dark green niqab. I considered brown or black, but the dark green counterpointed the tan dress for an earthy ensemble. Just because I was planning a heist, that didn't mean I couldn't look good doing it. Okay, you can stop pretending you know what a niqab is. It's a traditional Islamic headwear that covers the lower face. Combined with a hijab, head cloth, to cover my hair, only my eyes were visible. Great way to wear a mask without arousing suspicion. Next, I had to get a new gizmo. I couldn't use my own. That would leave a digital trail of all the illegal shit I was about to do. I could just see Rudy reviewing my gizmo's logs and building a case. No thanks. Life's a pain in the ass when you have a cop constantly on your ass. I needed a false identity. Lucky for me, it's easy to set up a false identity here, mainly because nobody cares who you are. Things here are set up to prevent identity theft, not aliases. If you tried to steal a real person's identity, you'd fail miserably. As soon as your victim found out, they'd report it and Rudy would use your gizmo to track you down. Where would you run? Outside? Hope you can hold your breath. I went online and converted a few hundred slugs into euros. Then I used those euros to buy slugs from KSC under the name Nuhad Najem. It only took 10 minutes of internet activity. It would have been faster if I were on Earth, but we have that 4-second ping time from here. I stopped at home and dropped off my gizmo. Time to become Nuhad Najem. I went to the Artemis Hyatt, a small hotel on Bean Up 6, with little flair but reasonable prices. They saw a lot of business from ordinary people taking a once-in-a-lifetime vacation. I'd only been there once before on a date with a tourist. The room was pleasant enough, but I'm not the best judge. I only got a good look at the ceiling. The whole hotel was one long hallway. The front desk was a closet-sized kiosk with a single employee. I didn't recognize him, which was good. It meant he wouldn't recognize me. "I greet," I said with a thick Arabic accent. Between that and my traditional clothes, everything about me screamed tourist. "Welcome to the Artemis Hyatt," he said. "Needing gizmo." He was used to broken English conversations. "Gizmo. You need a gizmo?" "Gizmo," I nodded. "Needing." I could see his thought process. He could try to figure out which reservation I was under, but as a Saudi woman, it would be under my husband's name. That would take a lot of pantomime and miscommunication to work out. Easier just to set up the gizmo for me. It's not like it cost the hotel anything. "Name?" he said. I didn't want to be too eager. I looked at him with confusion. He patted himself on the chest. "Norton. Norton Spinelli." Then he pointed to me. "Name?" "Ah," I said. I patted my own chest. "Nuha Najem." He typed away on his computer. Yes, there was an account for Nuha Najem, and no one had linked a gizmo to it. It all made sense. He pulled a weathered gizmo from under the counter. It was an older model with the words "Property of Artemis Hyatt" stenciled on the back. With a few keystrokes, he got everything set up. Then he handed me the gizmo and said, "Welcome to Artemis." "I think," I said with a smile. "I think many. Moon is much excitement." I had a fake identity. Time for phase two. I brought up the map app on my new gizmo and pretended to navigate with it. Obviously, I didn't need a map to get around Artemis, but it was all part of my tourist act. I wandered inefficiently across town to the port of entry. I carried a big purse, of course. What tourist woman would be without one? Now, for the tricky part. Everyone knew me at the port. I was there every day, and my sparkling personality was hard to forget. That's not ideal when you're trying to sneak around. But today, I wasn't Jaz Bashara. I was Nuha Najem, Saudi tourist. I headed to the waiting area next to the train airlock and joined a crowd of tourists. All the seats were taken and dozens more people stood around. Several families had obnoxious kids bouncing off the walls. In this case, bouncing off the walls is not just a figure of speech. The overstimulated kids were literally bouncing off the walls. Lunar gravity is the worst thing to ever happen to parents. "This is so cool," said a dumb blonde to her trust fund boyfriend. "We're about to take the moonarail." Ugh, only tourists called it that. It's not even a monorail. It runs on parallel tracks, just like trains on Earth. By the way, we also hate it when people call us loonies or when they call Artemis the city in space. We're not in space, we're on the moon. I mean, technically we're in space, but so is London. I digress. The train finally arrived. I pretended to be enthralled by its approach like everyone else. It was just a single car, not the long-ass trains Earthers are used to. It slowed to a crawl next to the docking port and inched forward until it connected. After a click and a ka-chunk, the round entry hatch opened up to reveal the conductor. Shit! It was Raj. Oh, he wasn't supposed to be there. He must have switched shifts with someone. Raj and I grew up together. We went to the same schools, we were teenagers together. We weren't close friends or anything, but we saw each other every day for most of our lives. My dress and hijab might not be enough of a disguise. He stepped through the aperture and adjusted his uniform. A silly 19th century style navy blue outfit with brass buttons and a conductor's cap. Giddy folks returning from the Apollo 11 site exited the train. Many of them carried souvenirs from the visitor center, lunar modules carved from local rocks, Apollo 11 mission patches, and so on. Once everyone detrained, Raj called out in a clear, loud voice, "This is the 2:34 p.m. train to Apollo 11! All aboard!" He held out a vintage-looking brass ticket shredder. Of course, there were no paper tickets to shred. It was just decoration surrounding a payment pad. I closed the niqab a little tighter and walked with a hunch. Maybe if I changed my body language, I wouldn't be as recognizable. Passengers filed past Raj, waved their gizmos over the shredder, and walked through an antechamber into the train. He made sure there was only one person in the antechamber at a time. He was sneaky about it, mostly by standing in people's way. It was easier than explaining, "If there's a pressure failure, the antechamber door will close. The city will be safe, but you'll die." When my turn came, I looked down to avoid eye contact. My gizmo beeped and popped up a text blurb. "City of Artemis, 75 slugs, train fare." Raj didn't notice me. I breathed a sigh of relief and stepped into the train. The seats had all been taken and I was ready to stand for the whole trip, but a tall black guy saw me and stood up. He said something in French and pointed to his seat. A true gentleman. I bowed to him and sat down. I rested my purse in my lap. Once the last passenger boarded, Raj followed and sealed both antechamber doors along the way. He walked to the front of the train and spoke over the intercom. "Welcome to the Lunar Express. This is the 2:34 p.m. service to the Apollo 11 Visitor Center. Our scheduled arrival time is 3:17 p.m. Please keep your hands and feet inside the vehicle at all times." A snicker rippled through the passengers. It was a stupid-ass joke, but comedic gold to the tourists. The train set off. It was utterly smooth. No rocking, no shaking, nothing like that. It ran on an electric motor, obviously, and the tracks never had to deal with the warping effects of weather. Plus, there wasn't much weight on them, compared to Earth tracks. Each row of seats had a porthole window. Passengers eagerly took turns looking at the drab, rocky landscape. Why did it excite them so much? It's a bunch of gray rocks. Who gives a shit? A frumpy Midwestern woman giggled at her window and turned to me. "Isn't it amazing? We're on the moon!" "Ma'alesh ana ma'aref englise," I said with a shrug. She turned to another passenger. "Isn't it amazing? We're on the moon!" Nothing like a language barrier to make people leave you alone. I brought up an Arabic gossip webzine on my gizmo. I just wanted an excuse to keep my head down. Fortunately, Raj was manning the controls and facing away. By the time we arrived, I had learned all about the latest scandal in the Saudi royal family. The crown prince had cheated on his wives. Two of them had filed for divorce under the Islamic law of Kula, but the other two were standing by him. I was halfway through reading the queen's quote on the situation when the train came to a stop. The familiar sounds of the docking procedure clanged through the car, and Raj shouted, "End of the line!" He walked to the door and opened it. "Apollo 11 Visitor Center, have an excellent stay." We all crowded out of the train and found ourselves in a gift shop. Some folks stopped there, but most of us continued forward to the viewing hall. That entire side of the center was floor-to-ceiling windows looking out over the landing site. A well-manicured docent greeted the crowd as we approached the glass. I averted my eyes. Yet another person I knew. God damn, it's annoying to commit crimes in a small town. Gunter Eichel had emigrated to Artemis 10 years earlier with his stepsister Ilsa. They came because they were ostracized in Germany for being a couple. Yes, really. That's why they emigrated. We don't care what people do sex-wise as long as everyone's a consenting adult, though some folks stretch the definition of adult. Anyway, he and I weren't friends or anything. My disguise would be fine. He waited for people to conglomerate, then launched into his presentation.
"Welcome to Tranquility Base. Come on up to the glass. There's plenty of room for everyone."
We moved forward and lined up against the giant windows. The lander sat where it had been for the last century, alongside experimental packages that the old-time astronauts had laid out.
"You may notice the viewing hall windows follow a veered path," Gunter said. "Why not just a half circle or a straight line? Well, we have a rule that nothing is allowed within 10 meters of any part of an Apollo landing site. The definition of any part includes the lander, equipment, tools, the commemorative plaque, and even the footprints left behind by the astronauts. The viewing hall is built so that each window is just over 10 meters from the nearest part of the site. Feel free to wander along the hall to get a look from different angles."
Some of the tourists had already walked along the serpentine wall. But with Gunter's suggestion, several more began the trek.
If you're nervous about the pane of glass separating you from the vacuum of space, don't be. These windows are 23 centimeters thick to protect you from the radiation. That has a side effect of making them the strongest part of the visitor center's hull, and I'm proud to point out the glass was manufactured right here on the moon. A small amount of regolith dust was added to darken it, otherwise the sunlight from outside would be blinding.
He gestured to the landing site.
The eagle, named after the national bird of the United States, landed July 20th, 1969. What you see here is the eagle's descent stage. Astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin took the ascent stage back into lunar orbit at the end of their mission.
The tourists pressed against the windows, entranced at what they saw. I took a long look myself. Hey, I'm not made of stone. I love my city and its history. The eagle is a big part of that.
Every Apollo mission planted an American flag, Gunter said. So where is it? Well, when the ascent stage lifted off, the exhaust knocked the poor flag over. Then the dust that had been kicked up covered it. If you look closely on the ground, just to the left of the eagle, you can see a small patch of white. That's the only bit of the flag still visible.
The crowd murmured as people pointed out the white bit to one another.
For later missions, they figured out to put the flags farther away.
A small chuckle came from the crowd.
Interesting side note. All the other flags have been exposed to unfiltered sunlight during lunar days for over 100 years. They've been bleached completely white now. But Tranquility Base's flag is under a thin layer of regolith. So it probably still looks like it did back in 1969. Of course, no one is allowed to enter or modify the landing site to take a look.
He clasped his hands behind his back.
We hope you enjoy the history and beauty of Tranquility Base. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to ask me.
Behind the crowd, Bob Lewis and two other EVA masters stood next to a doorway labeled EVA Preparation Area. Gunter gestured to the trio.
We offer curated EVAs to those who are interested. It's an amazing experience and allows you to look at the site from angles the viewing hall can't provide.
Usually Dale would be there among his peers, but today was a Saturday. He was devoutly Jewish and off at Artemis's only synagogue, Congregation Beth Chalutzim. A small crowd gathered around the EVA masters while the remaining poorer people stayed at the windows. I shuffled along with the EVA gang, trying to stay toward the middle. I didn't want to get too close to Bob. The masters divided us into three groups of eight. I ended up with Bob. God damn it. Each master took their group aside and explained the basics of how things were going to work. I stood in the back of my group and averted my eyes.
Okay, listen up, Bob said. I will be in a full EVA suit while you will be in what we call hamster balls. You are not allowed to bring anything sharp with you because you would puncture your ball and die. There will be no horseplay. You will walk, not run. You will not bounce around or ram each other. He shot a withering glare to a couple of teens in the group. There is a 1-meter-high fence around the landing site to protect it from you. The fence delineates the 10-meter boundary beyond which no one may pass. Do not attempt to get past the fence. If you do, I will terminate the EVA, and you will be deported to Earth.
He paused a moment to let that sink in.
While outside, you will follow my instructions immediately and without question. You will stay within sight of me at all times. You may explore in any direction you choose, but if I radio that you are too far away for my comfort, you will return to me. Are there any questions?
One small Asian man raised his hand. Yes, the docent mentioned there's radiation out there. How dangerous is it? Bob answered the question with practiced ease.
The EVA will last approximately 2 hours. In that time, you will receive less than 100 microsieverts of radiation, about the same dosage you get from a set of dental x-rays.
Then why is the visitor center shielded? Asked nervous guy. All structures on the moon, including the visitor center, are shielded for the benefit of the people who live and work here. It's fine to be exposed once in a while, but not all the time.
And what about you? You go outside all the time, right?
Bob nodded. I do, but each EVA master only does 2 tours per week to keep their exposure to a minimum. Anything else? Nervous guy looked down. If he had any further questions, he was too intimidated to ask.
Bob held out his payment panel.
The price for this EVA is 1,500 slugs each. The tourists ran their gizmos over it one at a time. I wedged myself in the middle of the pack and paid along with them. I frowned at my gizmo as it reported my dwindling account balance. This get-rich-quick scheme was costing me a lot of money.
Bob led us to the antechamber. As the most senior EVA master present, he got to take his group out first.
Deflated hamster balls hung on racks throughout the room. Next to each one was a hard-shelled backpack. The far wall had a large hatch and associated control panel. Beyond it was an airlock large enough to fit an entire tour group. Bob pulled one of the backpacks off the wall.
This is a scurry pack. You'll have it on your back during the EVA. This is your life support system. It adds oxygen and removes carbon dioxide as needed. It keeps the air at the correct pressure and temperature.
He turned the scurry pack sideways to reveal a headset velcroed to the side.
You'll have this headset on during the EVA. It's an open channel. All 9 of us will be on it. Also, your scurry pack will report any problems to me if they arise.
Nervous guy raised his hand. How do we operate it?
You don't, said Bob. It's completely automated. Don't screw with it.
I listened with fake fascination. Of course, I knew all about scurry packs. Hell, as part of my training, I'd been given several deliberately broken packs and told to identify the problems. I got every one of them right, too.
Bob pointed to a line of lockers.
Put your personal items and anything else you don't want to carry in those lockers there. Keep your gizmos with you.
The excitement level jumped a notch. The tourists were all smiles and giddy conversation. I went to the locker nearest me and waved my gizmo. It clicked open. Now it was initialized to my gizmo, so only I'd be able to open it again later. Elegant design. Even Nervous Guy was able to work it out without extra questions. I put my purse in the locker, then cast my eyes askance to see if anyone was watching me. No one was. I pulled the hib out of my purse and set it on the floor next to the locker bank. I couldn't get it completely out of sight, but at least it was partially occluded. I slipped the remote control into a holster I had strapped to my inner thigh. From there, we all donned scurry packs under Bob's watchful eye. Then, one by one, he sealed us each into our hamster balls. There were some stumbles and falls along the way, but most people adapted to the balls well. It's not that hard. Bob pulled his own EVA suit out of a locker and put it on in 3 minutes. Damn, he was fast. The fastest I ever got into mine was 9. We all lined up behind him, some more gracefully than others. He waved his gizmo over the airlock controls and the inner hatch popped open. He ushered us into the airlock. I got in first and rolled to the corner. I faced the wall, pulled the remote from under my dress and activated the hib. It came to life in the prep room and fired up its camera. I could now see everything from the hib's vantage point, as well as my own. Bob was paying attention to the tourists, which meant he was facing away from the hib. The tourists had their eyes locked on the outer door, the last barrier between them and an exciting experience on the moon. Also, hamster balls are pretty dark when you're inside. They're made to shield the occupant from harsh sunlight. So this was my chance. I had the hib scamper forward on its adorable little claws. It darted into the airlock beside the second-to-last tourist's hamster ball. Then it hid in the corner. Bob sealed the inner door and got to work on the outer door cranks. Nothing fancy for outer airlock doors, just manual valves. Why not a sleek computer system? Because valves don't crash or reboot. This is not something we take chances with. The air hissed out of the room and our hamster balls became more rigid. Bob continually checked his readouts to make sure all 8 of us had solid seals. Once the airlock was in vacuum, he addressed us over the radio.
All right, opening the outer door now. The tour area's been cleared of any sharp rocks, but if you see something that could possibly puncture your ball, don't mess with it. Just tell me.
He opened the outer door, and the gray, lifeless landscape lay beyond. The tourists oohed and aahed. Then they all tried to talk at the same time in the open channel.
Keep chatter to a minimum, Bob said. If you want to talk to a specific person, call them with your gizmo. The shared channel is for tour-related instructions and questions.
He stepped outside and gestured for us to follow. I rolled out onto the moon with everyone else. The scratchy lunar regolith crunched under my ball. The flexible polymer skin blocked most of the incoming sunlight, but that meant it all became heat. The inner layers of polymer were good insulators, but not perfect. Within seconds of stepping into the sunlight, I could feel the warmth in my air. The scurry pack fired up one of its fans, sucked in the warm air, and blew it out cold. Just like harvesters, hamster balls have to deal with the pain in the ass that is heat rejection. But you can't encase a person in wax. So what did the scurry pack do with all that heat? Dump it into a big block of ice.
Yep, good old frozen water.
A couple of liters of it. Water is one of the best heat absorbers in all of chemistry, and melting the ice takes even more energy. That was really the limiter to how long a hamster ball excursion could be. How long that block of ice would last. It worked out to be 2 hours. Bob closed the outer door once we were all through and led us toward the landing site. I'd left my little Hib buddy, I decided his name was Hibby, in the airlock on purpose. It was a short walk around the arc of the visitor center. I joined everyone else right up against the fence. Remember when I told Jin Chu the view was just as good from the visitor center? I lied. It's way cooler from outside. You really feel like you're there. Well, I mean, you are there, but you know what I mean. I took a moment to admire Neil and Buzz's old stomping grounds. It really was a sight. That was my history right there. Then it was back to work. The tourists fanned out to examine the site from different angles. Some of them waved to the visitor center windows, though we couldn't see in. From our side, the windows were mirrors. It's a hell of a lot lighter outside than in. I faced away from Bob as if I were admiring the lunar desolation. I pulled out the remote and fired up the Hib again. You might be wondering how a simple remote control unit could send radio waves capable of penetrating an Artemis hull. It's hard to broadcast through 2 6-centimeter aluminum sheets and a meter of ground-up rock. Pretty simple, actually. Like everything else in town, it sent data through the wireless communications network. The city had receivers and repeaters atop every bubble, even the visitor center. Wouldn't want to leave the EVA masters mute, right? There's no more powerful tool for safety than communication. So Hibby's controller could talk to him without any problems. The airlock was in vacuum, the default state of all airlocks. Right now, the next tour group is getting prepped by their EVA master. I had a short window of opportunity. I had Hibby crawl to the outer door. The screen highlighted areas that he could grab to climb. Fantastic AI assist. All I had to do was tell him where to go, and he worked out the rest. He grabbed pipes, valve handles, and other protuberances to climb up the door. I had him anchor himself against a reinforcement rib and grab the hatch handle. He needed 2 claws to get enough force to turn the handle, but it worked. After 3 full handle revolutions, the door was ajar. I had him drop to the ground. He automatically spun as he fell and landed on his claws. Man, he was fun to play with. I made a mental note to buy one after I was rich. Like a cat sneaking into a room, Hibby nudged the airlock door open and slipped through. Then he closed the door behind him. I looked over my shoulder to make sure no one was watching. Most tourists were up against the fence and Bob just scanned the scene. No one was breaking rules or in danger, so he was content. I had Hibby push the door closed, climb up it, and reseal the hatch. From there, I told him to get to the apex of the visitor center dome, a perfect place to stay out of sight. He climbed merrily up the side, finding a convoluted but effective path of handles and grips he could reach. It took him 2 minutes to reach the top. I put him in power save mode and reholstered the remote. I looked back to the dome of the visitor center and couldn't even see the apex from the ground. Perfect.
Phase 2 complete. I spent the rest of the tour checking out the Eagle. It's amazing to think people actually landed here in that thing. You couldn't get me to do that for a million slugs. Well, okay, I'd do it for a million slugs, but I'd be nervous about it. Dear Kelvin, Sean fucked up. I love the man, and he makes me howl in bed, but my God, he can be stupid sometimes. He got a hold of some pot, bought it off a tourist. We needed a place to party. Problem is, around here, if you smoke, you'll set off fire alarms. So where would we go? I have the perfect solution. Dad's new shop. Dad's expanding the business right now. He leased a second location. He's bringing in new equipment, interviewing welders to staff it, the whole nine yards. It's not up and running yet. Half the equipment hasn't even arrived. So it's just this big, mostly empty room that I know the lock code to. And hey, smoking in a fire-rated workshop is the responsible thing to do. Protecting the city from fire and all that. So I offered it up. We had a party. Nothing big. Just a few of Sean's friends and me. We got good and stoned. Then Sean and the guys started playing with the equipment. I should have stopped them, but everyone was laughing and having a good time. I didn't want to break the mood, you know? Anyway, turns out Dad had filled the acetylene tanks that day. So, while Sean and his idiot friends sword fight with the torch handles, the gas feed lines were actually live. Someone must have rolled a knob or something, because when they clashed the metal on metal, it made a spark. The whole room caught fire. The alarms went off, and it automatically sealed itself off. We were trapped in there, and we barely got to the air shelter in time. We all crammed in and waited for the fire brigade. Long story short, no one got hurt, but the room was trashed. Rudy, the nosy Mountie asshole, wanted to have me deported, but the fire destroyed all the pots, so he had no evidence of illegal flammables. Dad was pissed off. He yelled at me like never before, went on and on about how much money he'd sunk into that location, how it went up in flames because of me. And that just got me mad because, you know, I could have died. The least he could do is ask if I'm okay, right? We really got into it. He said I had to stop seeing Sean, as if he got a say in my love life. And then he went off on that same tired shit he always slings about me wasting my potential. I am so fucking sick of the word potential. I'm sick of hearing it from Dad, from teachers, and every goddamn adult I meet. I told him he had no say in who I date. He kept banging on about how I could make a difference with a mind like mine. Sean's a waste of time, blah, blah, blah. It's my life. I'll do what I want with it. I grabbed some of my things and got the hell out of there. I'm staying with Sean for now. So much nicer than Dad's place. Sean's only 23, and his place has its own bedroom and bathroom. He doesn't work his ass off just to barely survive like everyone wants me to do. He's a bookie, and he covers all his own bets. He's saving up to buy a table at the Starlight Casino. It's an Aldrin bubble. I'll find a job and stock up enough money until I can afford my own place. Or maybe not. Sean and I might just keep living together.
Dear Jazz, I'm so sorry to hear you've had a falling out with your father. I know you're mad, but please consider reconciling with him. Even if you don't want to live in his home, there's nothing more important than family. In other news, I got a job at KSC. I'm just an assistant loadmaster, and I weigh cargo pods all day, but it's a start. After a provisional period, they say they'll train me in payload balancing. It's very important that a payload be properly secured and balanced, or the launch could fail. If I work my way up to loadmaster, I'll be able to afford trade school for my sisters. Then, once they are all trained in skills, the four of us will be able to support our parents. Mom and Dad will finally be able to retire. It's a long way off, but my sisters and I are working hard to make it happen.
Dear Kelvin, sorry for the slow reply. These past 2 weeks have been pretty hectic. Sean and I got in a fight, but then made up. I'll spare you the details. It's all cool now. Congrats on the job. Some Saudi guys dropped by the other day and told me they'd set me up as a welding apprentice if I wanted. There are at least 5 master welders in town who want me in their shop.
The Hungarian machinists also dropped by. They figured welding and machining are similar and that they both involve metal. I don't follow their logic. Anyway, they think I'd be good at that. After that, the word got out that I'm available or something. A bunch of tradesmen have contacted me. Plumbers, electricians, glass workers, you name it. I'm suddenly the belle of the ball. Yes, I have a reputation for being good at whatever I set my mind to, but this is ridiculous. I smell Dad. This has his fingerprints all over it. He's got influence with the craftsmen in town. Either he directly asked them to talk to me, or they're just doing it because employing Amar Bashar's daughter would mean a strong business relationship with him. I turned them all down. I don't hate Dad or anything. I'm just trying to make my own way, you know? Also, to be blunt, those professions are a lot of hard work. I got a job as a porter. It's just a temporary gig to have some spending money. Sean pays the rent, but I don't want to rely on him for everything, you know? Anyway, I like it because I can work as much or as little as I want. There's no structure or boss or anything. I get paid per pickup or delivery. In other news, Sean is banging other women. We never declared exclusivity. I moved in because I had nowhere else to go, so I guess that's a weird situation, but it's okay. We worked out some rules. The main one is neither of us can bring anyone back to Sean's place. Go bang somewhere else. For me, it's largely academic. I'm not interested in juggling men. One's plenty. No, I don't like it. But Sean was very upfront about all this from day one, so I can't complain. We'll just see how it goes. Chapter 5. The next morning, I lay in my coffin and screwed around with the Hib remote. Hibby came to life right when I told him to. His charge was at 92%. No solar panels for my little Hibby, unfortunately. Why would the designers put those in? Hibs are supposed to be used a couple of hours at a time, then come back inside. I had him climb down the arc of the visitor center dome to just above the train airlock. Then I had to wait. I dicked around in my gizmo for a bit, mostly reading the Arabic gossip site. The queen actually sided with the wives against her own son. Can you believe that? You know you're a fuck-up when your own mother tells you so. Finally, the first train of tourists arrived at the visitor center. Hibby climbed down off the dome and onto the train car itself. The train ran perfectly on time. After 10 minutes, it departed for Artemis with my little stowaway aboard. Hibs have a nice battery life, but they sure as hell can't walk 40 kilometers across lunar terrain. So Hibby was riding back to town in style. Nothing but the best for my little buddy. I killed more time on my favorite gossip site while I waited for the train to get back to Artemis. Oh my God. I could not believe the shit the prince's second wife was saying about him in the press. That's just mean. Still, I can empathize with any woman who's been cheated on. I've been that woman. And honey, it sucks. The train made it back to town, and I had Hibby scamper onto Aldrin Bubble. Things got easy from there. Now I was using Hibby to do exactly what he was designed to do. He crawled along the outer hull of Aldrin, then across the top of the Aldrin-Conrad connector tunnel, and then onto Conrad. I had him take a position at the apex of Conrad. Then it was back to low-power mode for Hibby and back to trashy royal family gossip for me. Attention! You are entering Aldrin Park. The park is not protected by a double hull. If you hear the breach alert, immediately get to the nearest air shelter. Air shelters are denoted with blue flags and can be found throughout the park. Admission, non-residents, 750 slugs. Residents, free. I waved my gizmo across the reader and the booth door opened. Free entry for me, of course. Who says there's no such thing as an Artemisian citizen? I stepped into the booth and waited for the outer door to seal. Once it did, the inner door opened, letting me into the park. I stepped into the sunlight. Yes, sunlight. Aldrin Park occupies the top 4 floors of the bubble. Instead of the everything-proof walls found around the rest of the city, this area was protected by enormous panes of glass, the same kind the Apollo 11 Visitor Center used, proudly manufactured right here on the moon. It was 3 p.m. Nairobi time, and therefore 3 p.m. Artemis time. But physically, it was lunar morning. The sun hovered at the horizon and cast its light onto the park. The glass protected parkgoers from the harsh radiation and UV that would otherwise have roasted us alive. I still had time before my meeting with Svoboda. I took a walk. The park's design was simple and elegant. The circular grounds met with glass walls. The terrain was mostly flat, with a few artificial hills here and there, all covered in grass. Real, honest-to-God grass. That was no small achievement. I moseyed along the perimeter, looking out at the moon. I've never seen the appeal of lunar landscape. It's just nothing. I guess people like that. Some sort of Zen shit. Not me, though. To me, the most beautiful thing out there was the rest of Artemis. The city shined in the sunlight like a bunch of metallic boobs. What? I'm not a poet. They look like boobs. To the west, Conrad Bubble dominated the view. It might be grungy and impoverished on the inside, but the outside was just as pretty as its sisters. Southwest, the smaller Armstrong Bubble sat like a spider in the middle of a web. Farther along that line, Shepherd Bubble sat there full of rich fucks. I didn't think it was possible for a half-sphere to look arrogant, but it did. Bean Bubble sat between Conrad and Shepherd, both symbolically and geographically. It'd be my future home if all this scheming worked out. It was farthest from me. I looked to the north. The sea of tranquility stretched out as far as I could see. Gray hills and jagged boulders dotted the terrain all the way to the horizon. I wish I could say it was all magnificent desolation and crap like that, but it's not. The land around Artemis is crisscrossed with tire tracks and utterly denuded of rocks. We have a lot of masonry here. Guess where people get the rocks. I walked to the center of the park, toward the ladies. Real trees would have been too much to arrange, but the park featured a very realistic sculpture of a cinnamon tree. Two statues stood beneath it. One was Shang-Yi, the Chinese goddess of the moon. The other was Artemis, the Greek goddess our fair city was named after. The two women stood in frozen laughter, Shang-Yi's hand and Artemis's forearm. They seemed to be in the middle of some friendly girl talk. Locals knew them as the ladies. I walked up and leaned against the tree. I looked up to the half-earth in the sky.
"No smoking in the park," said a raspy old voice.
The groundskeeper was at least 80 years old. He'd been a fixture since the park opened. "Do you see a cigarette in my hand?" I said.
"I caught you once before."
"That was 10 years ago." He pointed to his eyes and then to me.
"Watching you."
"Let me ask you something," I said. "Who moves all the way to the moon just to mow lawns?"
"I like plants, and my joints hurt. The gravity here is easy on my arthritis."
He looked up at Earth.
"Once the wife died, I didn't have much reason to stay there."
"Hell of a trip for an old man," I said.
"I used to travel a lot for work," he said. "I don't mind."
Svoboda showed up exactly on time, as usual. He carried a bag over his shoulder and smiled. He pointed to me and the goddess statues. "Hey, look at that. Three hot moon babes hanging out." I rolled my eyes. "Svoboda, someday I'll teach you how to talk to women." He waved to the groundskeeper.
"Hey, I know you. You're Mike, right?"
"Nope," said the groundskeeper. He shot me a look. "I'll leave you and your John alone. No sex on the grass."
"Try not to age to death on the way home, Gramps," I said. He waved over his shoulder as he walked away. "Did you finish it?" I asked Svoboda.
"Yep, got it right here."
He handed the bag over to me. I peeked inside. "Thanks.
Did you get the chance to test that condom yet?"
"It's been 24 hours. What kind of sex life do you think I have?"
"Whatever, I don't know. Just asking."
He scanned the park.
"I don't come here often enough. It's a nice place to relax."
"If you like flying debris, yeah." The park was infamous for this. If you're from Earth, no matter how much you mentally prepare yourself, you always throw too hard. Your friend 10 meters away, the intended receiver, will watch a ball sail over their head to the other side of the park. And don't get me started on frisbees. Between the low gravity and the low air pressure, they're a complete mystery to tourists.
I like it, Svoboda said. It's the only natural place in town. I miss open spaces.
Plenty of open space outside to look at, I said. And you can hang out with friends in a bar more easily than a park. His face lit up.
We're friends?
Sure.
Cool. I don't have many of those. You're my only friend with boobs.
You really need to work on how you talk to women.
Yeah, okay. Sorry.
I wasn't mad. It barely registered. I was too busy obsessing about my plans. This was it. All the pieces were in place. I had the welding equipment, the custom electronics, and the HIB was ready. My breathing got short and my heart nearly beat out of my chest. My little caper wasn't theoretical anymore. I was actually going to do this. That night, I repaired the leaky valve in my EVA suit, and I gave the whole suit a thorough inspection. Then I gave it another one. I'd never admit it to Bob, but he was dead right about my shoddy inspection work before the test. It was my problem to make sure my suit wouldn't kill me. And this time, I made damn sure everything was in perfect working order. I got some sleep, but not much. I'm not a brave person, and I never claimed to be. This was it. The rest of my life hinged on how well I did. I awoke at 4 a.m., then I was too antsy to wait any longer. I walked to the port of entry, collected Trigger in my EVA suit, and drove through the corridors of the sleeping city to Conrad Airlock. No one was there this time of morning. I dropped off my EVA gear and the big sack of equipment for my heist, stowing it all in the antechamber so it wouldn't be visible to anyone walking by. I drove the now empty Trigger back to his parking space at the port. Tip, if you're going to commit a major crime, don't leave your car at the crime scene while you do it. I walked back to Conrad Airlock and closed myself into the antechamber. I just had to hope no one walked in on me or I'd have some splaining to do. I used duct tape to cover all identifying marks on my EVA gear. Serial numbers, license number, the big patch reading J. Bashara on the front, that sort of thing. Then I brought Hibby back online. He perked right up. Under my instruction, Hibby crawled down the arc of Conrad's hull to the airlock. He turned the crank to open the outer door. Then he dropped to the ground, nosed his way in, and shut the door behind him. He turned the crank again, sealing the door, then came over to the inner door. I watched my little buddy through the round porthole window as he grabbed the manual valves to let air from Artemis into the airlock. A quick hiss, then the airlock had equalized with the city. Hibby turned the inner door's crank and opened it up. I stepped into the airlock and patted him on the head. Good boy. I powered him down and stowed him in a locker in the antechamber, along with his remote. Well, there it was. An airlock all ready for use, and the control panel was none the wiser. I flipped off the control panel just to assert dominance. It didn't seem impressed. I suited up. I timed myself, of course. It's an EVA master thing. I took 11 minutes. Damn, how did Bob do it in 3? The guy was a friggin' prodigy. I fired up the suit systems. Everything came online just as it should. I ran a pressure test. As instructed, the suit overpressurized a little and monitored its status. This was the best way to check for leaks. No problems. I stepped into the airlock, sealed the inner door, and started the cycle. Once it was done, I opened the outer door. Good morning, Moon! It's not dangerous to do a solo EVA in and of itself. EVA masters do it all the time, but I was doing an EVA in secret. No one even knew I'd be out there. If I had a problem, no one would think to look for me. There'd just be a very attractive dead body out on the surface for however long it took someone to notice. I made sure my microphone was off, but left the receiver on to the public EVA channel. If someone else ventured outside, I'd damn well want to know about it. My 2 oxygen tanks had 16 hours of oxygen total. And I'd brought 6 more tanks with 8 hours each. Way more than I'd need, I hoped. But I was playing it safe. Well, I can't quite say playing it safe when I'm on an EVA and planning to fire up a welding torch on a moving rock harvester, but you know what I mean. My CO2 removal system reported green status, which was good because I don't like dying. In the old days, astronauts needed expendable filters to collect CO2. Modern suits sort the CO2 molecules out through some complicated use of membranes in the vacuum outside. I don't know the details, but it works as long as the suit has power. I checked my suit readouts again and made sure all the values were in the safe range. Never count on your suit's alarms to warn you. They're well designed, but they're the last resort. Safety begins with the operator. I took a deep breath, hoisted the duffel over one shoulder, and got to walking. First, I had to walk all the way around the city. Conrad's airlock faced north, and Sanchez Aluminum Smelter was south. That took me a good 20 minutes. Then, it took me 2 hours to get to the smelter reactor complex a kilometer away. It was disconcerting to see Artemis recede into the distance. Hey, look, it's the only place for humans to survive on this whole rock. Wave goodbye. I finally made it to the base of what we call the berm. When they designed Artemis, someone said, what if there's an explosion at the reactor? It's like 1,000 meters from town. That'd be bad, right? A bunch of nerds furrowed their brows and pondered this. Then one of them said, well, we could put a bunch of dirt in the way. They gave him a promotion and a parade. I embellished the details there, but you get my point. The berm protects the city from the reactors in the event of an explosion. Though the hulls would probably do that just fine, it's all about redundant safety. Interestingly, we don't need protection from radiation. If the reactors ever melt down, it won't matter. The city is shielded all to hell. I sat down and rested at the base of the berm. I'd had a long walk and needed a rest. I turned my head inside the helmet, bit a nipple, try not to get excited, and suck some water out. The suit's temperature systems also chilled the water. Hey, I spent a lot of money on that suit. It was quality gear when it wasn't malfunctioning and ruining my guild exam. I gave a mighty grunt and started climbing. 5 meters at a 45-degree angle. It might not seem like much, especially in lunar gravity. But when you're wearing 100 kilograms of EVA suit and hauling another 50 of equipment, believe me, it's work. I wheezed, gasped, and swore my way up the berm. I think I invented some new profanities. I'm not sure. Is fussamitch a word? I finally made it to the top and surveyed the lands beyond. The reactors lived in irregular-shaped buildings. Dozens of pipes led away to hundreds of shiny thermal panels lying on the ground. Reactors on Earth dump heat into lakes or rivers. We're a bit dry here on the moon, so we dump our heat via infrared light emitted into space. It's century-old technology, but we haven't come up with anything better. The smelting facility sat 200 meters from the reactors. It was a mini bubble 30 meters across with the hopper on one side. The hopper ground rocks into a coarse grid and put it in sealed cylindrical containers. The containers were sealed into pipes, which forced them into the facility with air pressure. Like an old-school pneumatic tube system from the 1950s. If you're going to have a bunch of air pumps and vacuum management systems in your facility anyway, you may as well take advantage of them. The train airlock stood on the other side of the bubble. The train tracks leading to it diverged into two lines. One ran to the airlock, the other to the unmanned silo car that transported rocket fuel to the port. I dropped a couple of meters down the berm and found a position where I could lie back and watch the scene. I had no idea what kind of schedule the harvesters had, so I would just have to wait. And wait. And fucking wait. If you're curious, there were exactly 57 rocks within reach. I sorted them from smallest to largest, then changed my mind and sorted them from most spherical to least spherical. Then I tried making a regolith castle, but it ended up being more of a lump. Regolith particles are barbed and they stick together well, but there's only so much you can do with EVA gloves. I could just about manage little half spheres of dirt. I made a scale model of Artemis. All told, I waited 4 hours. 4 goddamn hours. Finally, I caught a glint of sunlight on the horizon. A harvester returning to port. Thank God. I stood and prepared the duffel for travel again. I'd alphabetized my equipment out of boredom, first in English, then in Arabic. I hopped down the berm. The harvester and I converged on the smelter from different directions. I got there first. I crept around the bubble to stay out of sight of the harvester's cameras. No real reason to do that. It's not like anyone would be watching the feeds. I continued along the bubble wall until I got sight of the harvester. There it was.